My name is Terry Lindgren, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. By the grace of God and His fellowship, I've been sober since August 24th, 1975, and I'm grateful for that. My home group is the Foxhall Chapter 7 group in Minneapolis. We meet Thursday night, 7:30, and Brenda's butting in. You're all invited and encouraged to be there. Handshaking starts at 7, actually, so you're late if you're there after 7. Let's see, what else? I think that's all the business. I want to thank the committee for inviting us to come down here and spend the weekend with you guys. We had several events already that are noteworthy. We got in the hotel room a little earlier than our hospitality committee expected, and Brenda ran into somebody placing a basket of fruit and doing some nice things to welcome us. And I forgot what I was going to say about that. Okay, it's going good. Terry Lindgren, alcoholic. And, oh, I know what I was going to say about it. It was really very touching. So she was writing a little note. And she got all flustered because Brenda was walking in, and that settled down. But she was writing a note, and she signed it. It was kind of like a little thank you note, thanks for coming, et cetera. It was very polite. And it said something like, you guys are our heroes, or some of our heroes, or something like that. And I thought about that, and I thought, boy, that's really way up there. But then, maybe not. I don't know. I immediately thought, 30 years ago, I was nobody's hero. And when I hear hero in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I really think of is example. And I always hope that I'm a good example in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope that that's what that meant, because I got clay feet just like Brenda does. And so I appreciated that, and I had a chance to think about it a little bit. Another thing I want to mention was Aaron and Emily are our host and hostesses. Aaron's just the greatest host. I mean, he's a nice guy. I've known him for a long time. And he's just always been kind, considerate. He doesn't even act like a real alcoholic that way. What I was going to say was he's so kind that he always give you the shirt off his back. Except tonight, I forgot my shirts. So I needed a 16-inch neck shirt, and unfortunately his are a little bit bigger than that, so he didn't give me the shirt off his back, but he ran to the store and picked one up for me, so I didn't have to wear my T-shirt to the meeting tonight. So that's really worked out good. Okay, so, and I also wanted to mention that for a time while Steve was up at Minneapolis, I was his sponsor, and he certainly has improved since he got down here, so you guys are doing good. The other thing I would mention is this is like kind of like being at home here. I sobered up in Bellevue, Nebraska, and spent a few years there, moved to Sioux City, and spent, 6 or 7 years there, moved to Minneapolis, and then moved to Madison and moved back to Minneapolis. So I've been in this region for all my sobriety, and we've had lots and lots of times where many of you have been together with us, and so it's kind of like home, friendly faces and people that I've known over the years, and it's kind of cool. It's just like going to another one of our meetings, except it's a little bit bigger and it's in a really nice hotel, and so it's nice, and I appreciate seeing old friends, and I'm sure this weekend we'll make some new friends. And that's the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new and you stick with us for a while, you'll make friends that are an unbelievable friendship. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what friendship was. I don't think I had any friends left. And I didn't want to be a friend. I didn't know how to be a friend. I was very, very interested in my well-being and trying to fix whatever my problems were and so forth. And Alcoholics Anonymous and the members that I hung out with began to act like friends towards me and began to, kind of teach me how to be a friend. But at the same time, I started, it was almost like incurring an obligation. People were doing nice things for me when I didn't deserve it. And I started feeling like, well, maybe I got to give back a little bit. So the, the friends that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous are amazingly close friends and friends that typically will do whatever they can to help you out. And that was not the kinds of friends I had before I came to AA. The friends I had, well, I remember one of them, I was having some trouble with my wife. She was misbehaving, my first wife. And she was misbehaving, and she wouldn't let me sleep at home anymore. So I went to a friend of mine and said, hey, can I bunk out at your place for a little while? And so he said, well, I have to talk to my wife. And so what they talked about was how much rent they're going to charge me and how soon I was going to get out of there, you know, that sort of stuff. So that was one of my closer friends. So I didn't have much going when I came to AA, and it certainly has been a great experience building friendships over the years and getting to know people and so on. I grew up in Massachusetts, and when I was 18, I left there. And I grew up in an alcoholic home. My dad was alcoholic, and back in the mid-90s, he died with 34 years of sobriety. So I always knew a lot about alcoholism, a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous. He sobered up the first time when I was 9 years old. My earliest memories of things that were going on were kind of bad experiences. And in hindsight, I'm sure they were around alcohol. I mean, I can, little kid kind of things. I'm sitting in the middle of the room at a stranger's house. I'm sitting on the carpet, and there's a ruckus going on. And I know that hindsight says Dad was in the middle of it drunk and doing something stupid. Mom was yelling at him as usual. And I'm sitting there feeling bad as a little kid. And, you know, another time we're at they used to like to go to the Swedish American Club and drink there. I guess it was cheap drinks. And same kind of deal. I'm sitting someplace, maybe in the carriage or on the floor or whatever, and there's a ruckus going on. Mom's mad at Dad about the way he's behaving and so on. So there was a lot of that going on, and they fought a lot, and so there's ruckus. Dad sobered up when I was about 9, and all of a sudden things dramatically changed, and much of that change was that Dad was no longer home. He would work all day, come home, put on a coat and tie, white shirt, coat and tie, really looking sharp, jump in the car and head off to an AA meeting. They went to meetings every night. And for the most part, they'd go with four or five guys crammed in a car, and they'd go to a neighboring city and put on a meeting, and other guys would come to their meetings and so forth. So that was kind of the beginning of my awareness of AA. In fact, what I understood about it then was that my next-door neighbor had one of those AAA stickers on his car. And I said, well, Dad, how come you don't have a AAA sticker on your car? But I was to learn more about it as time went on. I learned something about sponsorship well before I was 12 years old. I knew that there was some strange relationship between Dad and his sponsor was supposed to keep him sober and, you know, do some good things and whatever. So I had picked up a lot of things, notions about Alcoholics Anonymous. And as I said, he sobered up the first time when I was 9, and he had his last drink around the time when I was 12 or something like that. My mom had gone to the International Convention in California. She was an Al-Anon, pretty active Al-Anon, and she was out there with Bill and Lois Wilson having a big time. And while she was gone, Dad decided that would be a good time for him to have a few drinks. And I recognized that he was acting strangely and knew that he'd been drinking, so I ran to the corner store and called his sponsor and told on him. He sobered up right after that, never had another drink, so I take full credit for sobering up my dad. But there was a lot to that. I knew that he cared about my dad staying sober. I knew that he cared about our family's well-being, and I knew that he wouldn't just, you know, be disinterested when I made that phone call. So that part of AA had already permeated my life when I was less than 12. And I mentioned that, and that's important. It was important for me, but as my kids grew up, I never realized how much influence Alcoholics Anonymous and the way we behave had influenced my kids. My daughter wrote a paper in high school or junior or senior year that was just an unbelievable paper. It was titled "The Impact That Bill Wilson Has Had on My Life" or something like that. And I didn't even know she knew who Bill Wilson was. But it was phenomenal. She knew more in her early years or, you know, high school years about Alcoholics Anonymous than many of us do after a time in Alcoholics Anonymous. So the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous had permeated her life just by hanging around. I've heard speakers say, well, you're not going to get this by osmosis. And you know, actually, I think you can. I think if you show up sober, stay sober, sit in these chairs, and participate as best you can. You can get this. At least that happened to me. It happened to my daughter, and so on. So anyway, that was kind of what the early days was like. I had a lot of high ideals back in those days. I was never going to drink. That was an issue, obviously. I was never going to smoke. I don't know why. Everybody else smoked then. And I was never going to cheat on my wife, because it seemed like there were a lot of people doing that. And I wasn't doing any of those things. I think I started smoking when I was, I don't know, 10. So my ideals didn't stick all that long. And I think I had, well, my first swallow of wine was very clear memory for me. I always had a strange reaction to alcohol, whether it was in my mind or in my mouth or whatever. I mean, they're just, anything that had to do with alcohol was kind of mystical, kind of magical. I think with all I knew about alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous, there was something down deep in me that said, boy, if all these people are willing to give up their lives, their wives, their jobs, their kids, and their cars, and their money, and their health for alcohol, it's got to be pretty good stuff. And I think that was deep down inside of me, no matter whether I acted that way or not. I was, before I ever took a drink, I would walk on, the guys that I ran around with and started drinking, they would walk the streets drinking beer, and it was probably getting warm and sudsy and whatever. They'd pop a beer, and I would sniff the suds off the top of the beer. I wasn't going to drink, but I did that. I would walk by a bar room and open the door and take a whiff, and I liked that smell. It's not so good today. So I had a strange reaction around alcohol from the very beginning. I said I wasn't going to drink, but then, I had that one swallow of wine, and that was about the conviviality of alcohol. I was hanging around with the guy that I deemed was the leader of the group. I never wanted to be the leader of the group. I always wanted to be in second place. I wanted to be the right-hand man to the guy who was the leader, because that was a well-respected position, and you didn't have to worry about making decisions or any of that stuff. So it was a good, safe place to be. And so I was with Ray, and we'd gone to his house, and he was making up a little dinner after school. And he reached in the refrigerator while the macaroni's cooking, and he pulled out a bottle of Mogan David wine. He opened it, twisted off the fine cap, and took a swig out of it. And he turned and handed me the bottle. And just like I never gave it a thought, I grabbed the bottle, and I did the same thing. Took a swig, gave it back to him. And I don't know. It was just a magical experience. It was so memorable. I can see that just live action right now. That was early teens. I don't know, 13, 14, something like that. And we went over his house a number of times after that, and I always waited for him to open the refrigerator door and get that bottle out again. And he never did. I must have taken too big a drink. I don't know. He got in trouble with his mom or whatever. So that was the first, and it was several years after that before I had another serious drink. And it was another one of them, I'm not gonna ever drink occasions. And I was with John, and John was going off in the Navy, and he bought a six-pack of beer. We were skipping school. I didn't mind doing that. And he had rented a McBen scooter. It had a motor on it. You know, it was pretty cool back in those days. And so the two of us were going to go out bombing around on this thing. We stopped off at this park area, and he's drinking. He says, have some beer. And I said, no, I don't have some beer. So anyway, I ended up drinking three beers, and then I really understood what alcohol was for. And it performed magic on me. I got really excited. All my cares went away. I was a worried kid. I worried about what you thought about me. I was a chameleon. No matter where I went, I was always trying to fit in, and I never felt like I did. And there was so much turmoil going on in my head and in my stomach all the time about where I was and what I was doing, how I fit in, and so on. I don't know what you thought of me. I had different groups of friends. I had the bad guys that hung around the neighborhood. I had the church guys. I had school guys. And you know, I'd run from all of them. I never really stuck with any of them. But anyway, that drinking experience took away all that inner turmoil and ruckus, and it just kind of freed me up. And it was exciting. So we had a little more time to ride on the scooter, and we're going down Main Street, Worcester, Massachusetts, and my legs are flying, and my arms are flying, and I am free, just having a wonderful time. This was great. He dropped me off at work. At that time, I was a magazine salesman, door-to-door magazine salesman, knocking on the door and saying, I'm giving away free magazines, and by the time I left, you spent $40 on magazines, and that was my job. And so before that, we would hang around this little meeting area where we would get the crew together, and then the guy would drive us out into the territory and drop us off. So I was there early, and I'm all by myself. I got a pool table there. And I'm not a good pool shooter. I hate that. I hate it. If I get to play, if anybody wants to be my partner and play or whatever, then I'm always going to make bad shots and I feel bad and I don't. It's just a terrible game. I hate it. But I want to be good at it and I like to have some fun. I like the guys that want me to play. And so it's traumatic. So I'm by myself. I pick up the broomstick that we're using to play pool with and I'm shooting pool. And I realize that I'm enjoying myself. What the difference was, having had a few drinks, is I started paying attention to the good shots that I made, and I ignored the bad shots. It changed my whole attitude upside down, and that's what alcohol generally did for me for a lot of time. I could look at things much more positively. I could look at the good things. I didn't worry about the bad things. I didn't worry about what you thought of me and so on. So an amazing transformation had taken place. And obviously, if it's going to be that good, then I wanted to do it again and again and again as much as I could. It's pretty hard to do a lot of drinking, although I took all the occasions that I could. And when I say it was hard, it's because Dad's so active in AA, and I had to drop out of Alateen. That was just didn't seem to fit with my new lifestyle. And little did I know, the rest of the Alateen guys were all drinking, too. They just wouldn't tell me because I was a goody-two-shoes guy, and I'd probably rat them out. And then Mom, being as active in Al-Anon as she was, it was tough. So I managed to get through high school and a two-year technical school and had a number of mishaps that were making things pretty ugly. My mother was pretty upset with me, and Dad was kind of standoffish. I had a deal with my dad that was always a very important deal to me. And that was basically I'd never lie to him. And as I started getting into trouble, I felt like I could talk to him about that. And the repercussions, there might be something, but it wasn't going to be too out of line, too dramatic. And it was because of this deal that I would always be honest with him. When he started asking me questions like, well, what happened last night? And I got three choices. Well, I burned my tuxedo, I bumped the car into somebody else, and I was drunk and driving or whatever, and I don't know which one to tell him. I don't know which one he found out about. And, I'm starting to lie. And I didn't like that, but that was the one big deal that I had between me and my dad, and whiskey just took that right away. So anyway, things were falling apart at home. I joined the Air Force, and I was one of the few guys in basic training really happy to be there. And I'd escaped. No more Mom and Dad worrying about what I'm doing and what I'm not doing. So as soon as I could, after basic training, I forget how long it was 6 weeks or something like that, I was trained now to go find the nearest bar and do as much drinking as I could, as often as I could. And that's basically what I did. After maybe a year or so of this, I had a lot of training. I went to a duty station. And I went there with a bunch of guys out of this tech school that I went with. And it seemed like those six or seven guys were really nice guys. And I wanted to be one of those guys. I wanted to be hanging out with those guys. And during the day at work, I was. I was kind of a part of what they were doing. But I felt like it was those guys and me. I never really felt like I was a part of those guys. And like I said, I wanted to be. They were good guys. And then there were older guys there that had been there when we got there. We were rookies, trainees, come into this shop. And these other guys had been around a long time. They had a lot of camaraderie. They did a lot of drinking together, a lot of traveling together. And they would. There was this little battle. We were in Texas. It's a little battle. These guys were mostly real Texans, so they put the radio station on some twanging radio station. And then the other guys that came with me, we'd run over and change it to the rock station. And, there was a lot of stuff going on. So we had good camaraderie at work. Then after work, I went to the bar, and they went elsewhere. They did other things. Sometimes I could talk one or two of them into going to the bar with me, and they might stay a couple hours, and then they go do something else. They go to supper, maybe. And I didn't go to supper. I might eat a cheeseburger in the bar or not. I just drink a lot of beer, and that had plenty of nourishment in it for me. But I ended up befriending some of these older guys because that's what they did. They went to the bar, and they stayed there all night, and that's who I hung out with. And it was always the same thing. There was this pushing and tugging. I wanted to be with those guys because they're cool, they're nice guys, and they're doing things, and they're getting to know San Antonio and doing what young guys ought to do. And all I do is I go to the bars as soon as I get off work, and I stay there until I'm stupid, and then I maybe find my way home and go to work the next day. And so I try to get them involved, and, they're just not getting it. One time, they were going out. The evening was this way. They're going to get something to eat, go to a movie, and go to a coffee house. none of those events included drinking for them. And I was crazy enough to say, yeah, I'd like to go with you, because I wanted to go with them. And so we went out to eat, and that was all right. And we went to the movie, that was all right. And I'm thinking, I didn't know what a coffee house was. This was back in the 70s, and or maybe earlier, I don't know. Anyway, coffee house had no alcohol, and that really surprised me. So I didn't want to stay, but I stayed. And as soon as these guys got back to the base, they all went off to bed. I went to the bar and spent whatever time left there was. And I never, ever did that again because it was such a terrible experience. My alcoholism would not allow me to live like that. Skipping forward a few years, I met a woman in a bar, and we became good drinking buddies. And then we got married and started raising a family. And towards the end of my drinking, I had two kids, a boy and a girl. And I had two stepchildren that came with my wife. And we were living in Omaha at Offutt Air Force Base, and I was in the Air Force. And I had got to the point where I'd been drinking pretty regularly. If we were going to have any kind of social event, we'd probably play cards and drink. I tried to pick somebody, had to be somebody else in the foursome of card players, had to be a heavy drinker, and then we all got along fine, and we could play cards till the wee hours and so on. So that was much of my entertainment. But in any case, things were really starting to eat at me in lots of different ways. One very important way, these kids were young. I think my daughter was maybe three or something like that, three or four. And I can see me sitting at my desk contemplating my checkbook, which I frequently did, but I'm blotto. I can't even see my checkbook. But this is, I got important business to do. Leave me alone. I'm drinking. I'm checking the finances here. We don't have enough money. Money's always a problem. Yak, yak, yak. And my daughter comes over, and she's tugging at my pants. She wants some attention. And every part of my insides pushed her away. I might have picked her up and put her in my lap temporarily, you know, give her a little pat in the back and then send her on her way. But I had got to the point where I had no ability to have a relationship with my young kids. I was a disciplinarian for the two older girls, and I was no husband to my wife. I had taken an attraction to a married woman at my second job, and so we had this thing I was never going to have an affair. That went out the window. And life was a terrible chaos for me. And I could not in any way blame that on alcohol. I never did blame that on alcohol. I think that had to do with what I knew about alcoholism, what I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I ever considered that I was alcoholic, I knew the answer. I knew the answer was stop drinking, go to AA, put on a coat and tie every night, go to an AA meeting. And I didn't want to do it. I mean, I was not even going to consider that that might be my problem. I did think there may be a mental health issue, and I was pursuing that to some degree. I was reading some I'm Okay, You're Okay books. And why am I afraid to tell you who I am? Because my M is not so good. So I had really everything around me was falling apart. My job was still okay, but my first wife was starting to meddle in that. She had called the colonel up and said, you know, he's misbehaving at home, and they have an interest in that. They don't, you know, I mean, sometimes they meddle in your business. It was not becoming of an officer to be having troubles at home. So I came home one day, and the colonel was sitting in my living room talking to my future ex-wife, and that was not a good experience. So things were falling apart. I was having trouble holding it together. I had separated basically from my dad and his new wife, and all my family's ties were cut. But the thing that was bothering me most was that I felt there was so much hopelessness in my life, and it was not the drinking stuff. And I just kind of blame it on my wife. If I get rid of her and have the other her, but she first had to get rid of her husband, and, you know, it's a little complicated, but if we could work all that out, my life might get happy again. But then what about the kids? And I don't know. I mean, it just went on and on. The only time I was relieved of that was when I was blistered. And otherwise, I was sober enough to think about it, and I wasn't happy about it. So alcohol allowed me to just defer that, but it kept getting worse and closer. So one thing led to another, and I decided that I was going to get divorced. But first, I wanted to make sure that was the right thing to do, because we were fighting all the time. had a lot of L-shaped tears in my shirts. And, okay, so nobody knows what that is. That's when you go out the door, and she grabs you by the collar and yanks you back. It rips your shirt right here. I had a lot of those, and so I didn't like fighting because she always won. And so anyway, things were getting progressively worse. I decided I was going to get divorced. I went to see a lawyer, and the lawyer, this is in Nebraska back in the, mid-70s, and at that time it was a no-fault divorce state, and the requirement was that you demonstrate that you had tried to reconcile your differences. And I couldn't think of any way that we'd done that, so I had to go see his counselor, and the lawyer referred me to the counselor, and the first thing the counselor starts doing is reading me these 20 questions out of this goofy pamphlet about my drinking. And I said, no, you don't understand. I'm not here for that. I'm here because I have a problem with my wife, and I'd like to get divorced. And it was the strangest thing. I have no idea how this happened, but he had some awareness of alcoholism, and he referred me to a counselor who was a brand new counselor, and he had no awareness of alcoholism. And so I kind of got away for the time being. So I spent a little time with this counselor who was kind of a rookie, and we did a lot of really, I guess you'd call them psychological experimentations or whatever, I don't know. We did a lot of shrinky talking, never really got to the problem, and I never tell him about my drinking. Occasionally that come up, I'd say, yeah, I drink a little bit, but, you know, whatever. He said, well, I said it was not an issue. He said, okay, it's not an issue. So that's what we did. Now, I went to this guy. I had no money back then. I was working two jobs, and it was awful. So this was a deal there at Hennepin County. You could pay what you could pay, and I could pay $3 a visit. So I was getting $3 worth of counseling once a week, an hour's worth, and I would learn from him, and then I'd go counsel me for the rest of the week. And you can't fix a broken tool with a broken tool, and that's what I was working on. As I mentioned, I read a couple of those really cool books. I was absolutely convinced I had a mental problem, and if I could just get a grip on what that was, then life would be okay, and I could make proper decisions and, you know, get through the rest of my life. After a period of time there, I had something came up at home, and I decided that I thought my dad had stayed with my mother until all of my siblings were old enough to fend for themselves, and then he was out the door and got a new wife. And I was faced with this decision: should I go out the door and they're not grown up, or should I hang around in this ugly marriage and wait until they're older? So do I stay in the marriage for the sake of the kids or not? That's kind of it. And I was really leaning towards the idea that hanging around with a bad marriage is worse on the kids than to be separated. Anyway, so I decided I'm going to go home and talk to Dad about this. And I don't know if we ever talked about that, but somehow the drinking thing got into it, so I didn't drink while I was home. And I was there for, I don't know, 10 days or something like that. And Dad was very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. He had been the secretary of the Wednesday night AA, Auburn AA group for, I think, most of his life. They didn't rotate much back in those days. He had a little card index at home with all the members' names and numbers on it, and he'd keep that up to date, and he'd call them up and ask them to do stuff. And so he basically ran that meeting. And and on the East Coast, I think they still do this, but back then they raffled off a big book every night. And typically it'd end up in the hands of a newcomer one way or another. But so everybody customarily bought three tickets. They cost a quarter. The real gamblers would buy 12 of them for a dollar or whatever and try to win. And ordinarily, I knew that I would buy those tickets. I always did as an Alateen and whatever. So I would have done that. But I was so busy talking to old friends, guys that I saw sober up in my house, Dad's Pigeons, and guys that I knew and so on. I was having a great time. This was a social event here. And so the bell rings. We've got to sit down for the meeting, and I didn't get my raffle tickets. My dad sits down next to me, and he says, did you get a raffle ticket? I said, no. He ripped one off of his tree and handed it to me. There's 200 people in the room. They all got at least three raffle tickets or more. And when they pulled the raffle ticket, it's mine. Now, I absolutely knew my dad fixed that raffle. and he may have. I don't know. But in hindsight, I'd say that God decided that I should start paying a little more attention to Alcoholics Anonymous and got my own copy of the book. It drew an awful lot of attention I didn't care much for after the meeting. People come up and shaking my hands and giving me advice and suggestions and so on. My grammar school girlfriend was at that meeting, and she came up, and I remember her advice was, just try to relate. Read the stories in the back. And I was so excited about seeing her. I heard that advice and everything. So it was really a cool time. But that was really the beginning of in my mind, God's intervention and bringing Alcoholics Anonymous to the forefront in my life. I went back home, and I thought I was going to stay sober experimentally. I went to an AA meeting in South Omaha, and they did for me what I hope we always do for a new guy that walks into Alcoholics Anonymous. I got there too early. I should never have gotten there as early as I did. And they started talking to me, and there was two guys. That one guy hadn't been sober very long, and one guy seemed like he was kind of the old-timer. And so they kind of let me know what was going on at the AA meeting. They introduced themselves a little bit. They were very friendly, not overly friendly. They were just very friendly, comfortable, told me where I was going to sit, what was going to happen when the meeting went on. So they basically introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. They introduced me to their group and to themselves. And that was pretty good. And I sat down at the table, and I think they told me that I could pass or whatever, and you know, I didn't have to say anything. So everything went good. And then I tried to bolt out of there after the meeting, and again, they want to talk. And we sat on the steps for maybe an hour while they told me more stuff. And I have no idea what they said, but I had their phone numbers, and I was pretty well convinced they cared about me being in Alcoholics Anonymous if I cared to be there. And I went away with that. Well, apparently, the old guy must have told the new guy that that's your pigeon, and you're going to chase him around, sober him up. Because this new guy called me every night for the next several days. I'm too busy. I got his job. I got this going on. I'm not coming. No, thank you, and all that. And after a few days, he stopped, and he just kind of let it go. Now, he had extended the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. They had given me every invitation to participate with them in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was their observation that I wasn't ready after a few days, and they kind of let me go. But that made a tremendous impression on me in terms of how welcoming they were and how selfless they were in paying attention to me as a new guy. I didn't have to sit there and stare at the wall or thumb through the literature like sometimes some of our newcomers do. So that was a very valuable experience. And I'm not sure that I ever saw those guys again. And it was several months later that I finally got in a situation where I just had to make a deal. I had made such a mess that the offering was this. If I went to an AA meeting on Monday night, this is Friday, I'm seeing my counselor and her counselor, and we got this session going on, and we're trying to fix things. I'm living in my travel trailer, and things are just chaotic. But I can move back in the house. I can keep my girlfriend, and my future ex-wife would stop giving me grief if I just went to AA on Monday night. It's not a bad deal, huh? I took that in a minute. Now, Saturday night, I went out and got blistering drunk, and that was my last drunk. And I was in no way alcoholic. I did not have a drinking problem. I had a living problem, a wife problem, and money problems, and things like that. And if I could get this mental problem fixed, I could fix all those things. I'm struggling with that. So Sunday, I was so hungover. I never really got the hang of this morning drink and to recover quickly. I just suffered. I figured that was kind of the price you pay. You know, you're going to go out and do this, you got to feel bad the next day. So I didn't drink on Sunday, also because I knew I was going to AA, and I didn't want you guys calling me alcoholic. So I didn't drink the next day, Monday. I went to work, and I went to the AA meeting on Monday night. One of the worst AA meetings I've ever been to. And I would say that honestly, openly. There was a bunch of new people there. They didn't really know much about Alcoholics Anonymous. They'd spent $30,000 to go through treatment, and they had a lot of things that they knew what to say about or talk about, but it was there was still that consistent Alcoholics Anonymous message that they were glad I was there, and I was free to figure out if I was alcoholic, if I wanted to or not. They offered their phone numbers and encouraged me to come back, and you know, it was that same message. And that counselor that I saw that read me the 20 questions, he was running this little AA group. So I was a familiar face, and I imagine he had his chuckles. But anyway, when it came time to introduce ourselves, I did not introduce myself as an alcoholic. I just said, my name's Terry, and I'm here because I made a deal or something like that. And they said, whatever, keep coming back. And somehow or other, I got enough out of that AA meeting and my environment to not drink for a whole week, and I went back to that meeting. I don't know why, but I did. And I've never had another drink since. So I went, you know, for the wrong reasons, I went to the worst AA meeting I could ever imagine, and I ended up getting and staying sober. So, you know, I mean, what can you say about that? Alcoholics Anonymous has got some real magic in it, no matter what shape or form it's in. Now, I kind of like things to run a little better than that in my AA meeting, and I hope that I can contribute to that. But in any case, I got the message of Alcoholics Anonymous enough to come back. Now, for the first several weeks, I stayed sober for lots of different reasons. and some were pride. I went and saw my girlfriend. I think I said something like, I haven't had a drink in over a week. And I was like, so? And she hadn't got the picture yet. But there are others who had the picture. And I developed a little bit of pride around this not having a drink. That wouldn't last. That's not going to keep you sober. If you get pride tonight, you better get something else. But it was enough for that amount of time. Then I started debating. People would say stuff, and I didn't get it. Like, they talk about the first step, and life's unmanageable. And I say, and I'd hear things like, well, turn it over. And I just hated it when somebody said that. Because turn it over to what? What are you talking about? Well, it's God. Oh, yeah, right. Where's God? What is that? So I was in this terrible debate, and it was going on a little bit in the meetings and sometimes afterwards, and they tolerated all that stuff. You know, it's a just keep coming back attitude, and they tried to help me a little bit. And I think on my third week or fourth week back, I actually tried to introduce myself as an alcoholic. And I said, my name is Terry, and I'm a couldn't get it out. I honestly did not believe that I was alcoholic, and I definitely did not want to be an alcoholic. I'm just in here to get my act together. You guys got a lot of pointers on living. The book's got some good pointers in there about living good. If I can just fix this mental problem, I'm out of here. And somehow or other, I just kept coming back. And one night I whined a little bit to Nob. I said, this isn't working for me. And Nob says in his cocky way, well, you're just not working it. Oh, boy, I stayed sober on resentment then for a couple of weeks. And so, you know, I'm kind of going through a few terrible reasons for staying sober. And the message in my mind is, I don't care how or why you're staying sober. If you can go to AA and stay sober, you have the opportunity to find the greatest thing in your life. And that's what happened to me. Not quickly, slowly. They kept saying, you got to go to more meetings. I said, I can't. I got this full-time job. I got a part-time job. I got a wife. I got a girlfriend. And I got all this stuff. And they would say, well, how about Sunday morning? And this one guy, I love breakfast, and I'm out of the house again. And so he said, we'll go to this AA meeting, or you go to church with me on Sunday. And after that, we'll go over to this AA meeting, and they have breakfast over there. And I said, yeah, that sounded pretty good. I didn't like the church thing too much, but the breakfast thing sounded good. So I went to that meeting. So I started picking up a second meeting. And that had a little more old-time sobriety. I took a guy's phone number there that I described him as the kind of guy who really had no bull in what he was saying. I mean, he's just kind of straightforward, straight out there. So I liked him, and I took his phone number in case. They said, get a couple phone numbers, put them in your wallet in case you ever feel like you need to talk to somebody. If you call these numbers before you take a drink. So I had his phone number. Soon after that, I got my sponsor's phone number, so I had two in my wallet. But Leo was really a cool guy. I didn't realize it at the time. He'd been in and out of AA for years. And he had a pretty bad track record. He was good talking at the tables, but not so good staying sober. When maybe that's why I identified with him. I don't know. But anyway, I was attracted to him. I had his phone number. Soon after that, Peggy and Dick had started coming to this goofy Monday night meeting that I was going to. And they brought Rational AA with them, and they started talking about steps and the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember saying to Peggy one night, I could see her. She's sitting across the room. She's got a denim shirt on with a little painter's palette up here. And she's just cute as can be. And I said to her, I don't understand you professional AAs. And that was because she was talking about all these AA things that we do. And the others were talking about how we feel and what we're going to fix and things like that. So she was in a different class of AA in my mind. And I think she probably went home and told Dick this little story. And Dick came the next week. He'd never been here before. And Dick began to sponsor me. And I say that because he showed some interest. He paid attention to what I said. He talked to me before the meeting. He talked to me after the meeting. He started answering questions I wasn't even asking. And we never really talked about whether he was my sponsor or not. I never wanted a sponsor. I'm not ready for any of this stuff. But I did take his phone number because he seemed to have a conviction about him, about Alcoholics Anonymous being able to save us, to really change our lives, and bring about the hope that I'd been looking for and hadn't been able to find. So that looked like a good phone number. I usually felt good after going to a meeting. And I was living in this lonely little apartment right now, and I had my golf clubs, the picnic table, and the mattress out of the travel trailer in there, so I wasn't furnished very well. And I walked into that apartment all lonely and upset one night, and like I said, I usually felt better. I would go in and go to bed and whatever, but I just had this sinking feeling in my stomach. It was like, oh my God, I can't do this. What's going on? This is horrible. And all of a sudden, I started thinking that my body, by this time I wanted to stay sober. I didn't know if I was alcoholic or not or whatever, but I wanted to stay sober. And I started imagining that my body was going to carry me out the door and go drink. And the vision I had was I was a horse with blinders on, and I was just going to the bar. And I would not be able to stop me from doing that. And so I had these two phone numbers in my wallet. They had said, call, you know, if you feel like you're going to take a drink. So I, military guy, I followed the instructions. And so I called Leo. And I talked to Leo probably for an hour. He was clearly watching TV when I called. I messed up his TV program, I could tell that. He wasn't all that enthusiastic about talking to me. But he did. He spent, you know, maybe an hour with me. And it gave me a little taste of what that, you know, connection is about. So he did what he was supposed to do. He just, you know, he might have been having a drink at the time. I don't know. But in any case, he was helpful to me. And after I got off the phone, I did a typical alcoholic thing. I said, one's good, two's better. And I called Dick. Dick and I spent maybe an hour on the telephone. And Dick, on the other hand, was very enthusiastic about talking with me. And I have no idea what we talked about. But when I got off the phone, I had gone from a condition that I would describe as despair to one of elation. And that elation was the hope of Alcoholics Anonymous about how good my life could be. And like I said, I don't know what he said. We've talked about it since. If we could figure out what he said, we'd probably write a book, sell some tapes, and I'll put something together and make a few bucks. We could save many. But I think probably the message was for me uniquely at that time. But one of the things that was clear, Dick cared about my well-being. He wanted me to stay sober, and his suggestion was increasing my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was offering to help. That was kind of the message. And in my mind, that is our message. That's what we do with new guys. We offer to try to give them some help and guide them into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous so together we can 12-step them and help them. My life changed dramatically after that. I started following suggestions, and soon after that, I asked Dick to be my sponsor. He has some stories about his reaction to that, but in any case, he did agree to be my sponsor, and it has been a tremendous relationship. I'm one of the very lucky people who have had the same sponsor ever since I had a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous for the long haul, and I've never, ever considered that I didn't have the right sponsor. I've been upset with him a couple times. Only once did I tell him. And I'm not going to get into that. But it's been just a fantastic relationship. And that relationship was basically wrapped around AA. He helped me. He said, well, you need to make a deal with yourself. Go to a meeting every night for 6 weeks. So, oh, can't do that. Got a wife and a girlfriend and the dogs and the kids and all that stuff, two jobs. And soon after that, he helped me to figure out how to lose job number two and still pay my bills and get to more AA meetings. That's his job as my sponsor. He didn't care if I had two jobs or not. He just wanted me to go to AA. And if that's the obstacle, fine. He never told me to dump the girlfriend. And I was still married. He never told me to dump the girlfriend. I think I sensed that he thought that might be a good idea. But that was not the issue. The issue was Terry and Alcoholics Anonymous participating, getting the meetings as much as possible, talking with him. And he would share his experience in Alcoholics Anonymous with me. He would share the experiences of others he knew in Alcoholics Anonymous with me, probably to make a point, but more than that, really just sharing his experience with me. And for the most part, I'd sit there and listen, occasionally ask a dumb question. Once in a while, he'd pull the book down from the shelf and refer to something in the book, but for the most part, he was just sharing his experience. And I grew to trust Dick, trust him to the point where I would put my life in his hands. And basically, I did that. There were many times when he suggested I do something or not do something where I wasn't 100% on board, but I did it because I knew he had my best interest at heart. And I hope as sponsors, that's what we do. It's not a mechanical thing. It's not a system of working with a newcomer. It's somehow or other sharing your life and your experience with a new guy. And that's what he did with me. Around the time I was sober, 6 months or something like that, it was unbelievable the way this sequence of events. I was really tormented about what to do with the wife and the kids and so on. And I'd moved in and out of the house a couple times. I said, I'm moving back with her, Dick. And he said, oh, I don't think that's a good idea. And I said, I really think I should. I've seen some miracles in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I saw people who would sober up in AA and their lives will get better. Their relationships with their wives will get better. And I thought, well, okay, maybe I've made a mistake here. And after being back in the house again for 2 weeks, I said, whoa, I made a mistake moving back here. And this time Dick said, nope, stay there. I mean, you can't keep bobbing around like this, and so I'm going to stay there. And things got really bad one Friday. I tried calling him. I said, got to go, Dick. I can't do this anymore. This is crazy. And he wasn't there, so I operated on my own. I went out and searched for a flea bag hotel room. I could only afford $50 a week and whatever, and so I'm busy going crazy. And a little later, he said, no, just stay there. Sleep on the couch. Stay away from her. Be reasonable about it. You can just stay in that house. Okay. And he's just trying to get me to settle down. So that was on, I think that was Friday, and Monday or Tuesday, my boss at work came to me and said, hey, one of the guys had to cancel out of this 6-week class in Biloxi, Mississippi. Would you be interested in going to that class? Could you make that? I said, whoa, yes, I could. And what was really cool about that is nobody had ever asked me to travel anyplace. And I don't think he had any new set of confidence in me. He didn't know about my drinking problem and all this other goofy stuff going on. He just knew he needed somebody to go to Biloxi, Mississippi for 6 weeks. I called Dick up and I said, what do you think of that? He said, I think you should go. And so I think it was like 2 days later, I'm going. And in my mind, God said, okay, I'm going to give him a break, get him out of this chaos, turmoil, go down there. Now, Dick prepared me for that. I'm 6 months sober, almost 6 months. He took the directory out, which, by the way, there's been some ruckus about should we have a directory or not. I think we should because of things like this. He took this directory out and he searched through it and he looked up the groups that had contributed the most money. He looked up the groups that had the largest population and he described those groups as being pretty active groups. And there was a name there and a phone number. And he said, when you get here, I want you to take this guy. He never talked to this guy. I want you to take this guy, call him up as soon as you get there. That's Sunday afternoon. I want you to call this guy and tell him what you need. Or whatever. Anyway, explain that I need help. So that's what I did. I went down there and I called Henry. And Henry said, I'm old and I don't get around much anymore. So you say, well, that book's no good. You throw that book away. No, Henry said. But you might call Helen. Helen's a real active person around here and she's got a lot going on. Call her. So I called Helen and Helen led me right into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous in Biloxi, Mississippi for the next 6 weeks. I had the greatest time of my life. It was so exciting. I met with people before meetings, after the meetings. You sit at coffee and do this stuff. And Dick had told me, while you're doing down there, by the way, I want you to do your fourth step. I had no time to do this fourth step. I was out so late every night. I got to do my schoolwork and whatever. I'm having a great time. They were so excited about my enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous, they asked me to give a talk at the, I think it was a Wednesday night meeting. It was supposed to be an hour, 50-minute talk. And so Helen, sitting in the front row, she's got a little tape recorder. I'm petrified. I have never done this. I don't know why I'm doing this. I'm just scared to death. I do not want to be doing this. She's got this little tape recorder in the front row, and it's one of them tapes that 30 minutes, you got to flip it over. So I'm talking away. I don't know what I'm saying, and probably still whining about being scared. And all of a sudden, that tape clicks. And when the tape clicks, my brain just shut off. I was absolutely done. And I stood there for a minute, and I said, oh, I got nothing. So it was the most humiliating experience of my life. So I'm definitely not a circuit speaker. You'll know that. And it was because of that goofy tape. Anyway, the hum of self-awareness was alive and well that night. And so we ended the meeting early, and a lot of people were pretty happy about that. But what was horrifying is the next day some idiot asked me to talk at the Saturday night meeting. And I said, no way, I can't do that. Did you see what just happened here? I can't even talk for half. Whatever. Helen said to me somewhere in the course of the next couple of days, you got to do this thing because there's going to be a Navy guy there for his first AA meeting. I was in the Air Force. There's a Navy guy going to be there for his first AA meeting, and he really needs to hear your story. And mind you, we've had a lot of coffee conversations, and I am an enthusiastic AA member. I just can't talk in front of a group. And anyway, all of a sudden I got a new purpose. I'm thinking, oh, my God, I got to do something to help this guy. And that's really the good news of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're able to do things for others that we can never do for ourselves. That Saturday afternoon was just a bizarre experience. I'm in my hotel room, and this is when God came and actually talked to me directly, first time, last time. And I was so worried. I'm scared to death that I am going to fail this new guy in giving my talk. So I'm not worried about what you think about me. I'm worried about not doing the right kind of job for a new alcoholic who needs to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought to myself, maybe I should have a couple of aspirin in case I get a headache. And so, you know, the thoughts are really going pretty bizarre here. And then I realized, I said, isn't that typically alcoholic? You know, I got a little problem, so what? Have a couple of aspirin, maybe it'll take it away. And I kind of chuckled. And when I did, there was a sense of relief that came over me. It was pretty emotional tonight. It was amazing. And I realized that God was giving me some level of comfort so that I could go attack this mission. And that night was really kind of cool because I was scared to death going to the podium. I never did see whether that guy was there or not. And I don't today know whether Helen might have made it up for all I know. She was pretty crafty. But I was scared to death. And when I got to the mic and I opened my mouth and I said, my name is Terry and I'm an alcoholic, that's all I remember. And I remember sitting down in a timely fashion. And it felt like I had done something good, but I had absolutely no memory of that talk. And they taped that talk. And I never wanted to listen to it. I went to listen to it one time, and it was all garbled. I couldn't understand what I said. So I never know if I did anything good at all. But the whole principle of what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous came through that experience for me. You know, if I'm doing something for somebody else, I'm going to get some power to go do that job. If I'm worrying about doing it for me and you know, the hum of self-awareness is in the way, I'm probably not going to do so well. And so that message was burned in, and my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous has been modeled after doing whatever I can to try to help other alcoholics. Dick is a great example of that. He pushed me into doing things that, you know, I would even argue with. One time he told me to go stand at the door and be a greeter, and my mental gymnastics said that, well, I'm a new guy, so that's not right for me to be greeting old guys. It's like a, you know, seniority thing or something, military thinking, I guess. And you know, it just didn't seem right. And I'm going through all this gymnastics, and I think I said something to him, and he said, I don't care about all that. Just go over there and greet the people. And so I'm scared to death greeting people. And after about 3 or 4 weeks of doing that, I own this meeting. And I'm really glad you came. And I'm so involved and confident. A whole transformation had taken place just by doing something that I was told to do and doing the best job I could at it. And it was an amazing experience. And that continued throughout all of my AA activities. And I've been led into participating in AA and general service and in a group and in my home group and so on. Okay, I sobered up in Bellevue. I was there for about 3 years. I got a great opportunity to move to Sioux City, Iowa to be a salesman for IBM, and so I took that. I was a little scared to leave my home group, didn't want to leave, and occasionally would run down the 90-mile highway to visit them and get restoked. And while I was in Sioux City, Iowa, things began to happen. I had gotten divorced. I don't know if I told you that. I got divorced. And so I was a visiting dad and so on, and my wife was having a terrible, or my ex was having a terrible time taking care of the kids, and I would say warm, compassionate things like, well, if you can't do it, I will. And so I was really, you know, selling her on giving me the kids to take care of. And I was pretty confident that I could do a much better job than her. And anyway, after a little bit of that, I was able to lose that attitude and be a little bit better ex-husband. And at some point, I didn't even check to see if I could get custody of the kids. The lawyer said, no way, you just be a good guy, stay sober and do what you can. And you know, maybe after a time something will work out for you. She called me one day in April, and she said something to the effect, can you take the kids for a while? I just can't do it. And I said, whoa, you bet. So I came down to Bellevue. We had a little meeting and over dinner, and we were making the arrangements about how we're going to do this, and I started rattling about getting custody and stop and support and all the mechanics of doing that, and she just went crazy. She said, I just said I want you to take care of them for a little while. I don't want to do all that stuff. And I was smart enough, bright enough, I had whatever it was to say, okay. And so I got the kids. And the lawyer told me, he said, you just keep the kids as long as you can. The longer you keep them, the better chance you got of keeping them. And I said, oh, okay. And he said, what about my child support and all that stuff? He said, I'll write the court a letter. So he wrote the court a letter saying he's got temporary custody of the kids. He's not going to play child support during this time. All parties are agreeable, and the letter went on file. So they never chased me around for child support. I got the kids, and the girl I was living with at the time did not want to participate in this event. So she bailed, and that was the best thing that ever happened to me because, I mean, it was a goofy relationship anyway. So she bailed out, and I'm trying to hire a person to help me take care of the kids. I'm a salesman. I got to travel. I got a job. I don't know how I'm going to do this. So I ran ads in the newspaper. I was thinking I was going to hire a little old lady who had lost her husband. She had blue hair. She was moving the house. She was going to make apple pies and, you know, take care of the kids. And it's going to be great. You know, like grandma came back. And that was kind of what I was looking for. The first woman I hired, the day she was supposed to show up, she was going to move in, she left a note on the door, like kind of an emotional note, said, "I just can't do this." And I don't know whatever that meant. But she basically quit before she started. And so I'm still, I got the paper and we're running out of time. I'm getting nervous here. What am I going to do? And I get another applicant. And she comes to see me, and she's this gorgeous 20-something-year-old blonde. I have no idea why she wants to be a nanny or whatever we were calling it at the time. And but I said, okay. Well, I checked her references, and her references were like this. She'll be great with your kids. She's really a great girl. Just every once in a while, she gets a little upset, a little nervous, whatever. But, you know, she'll be fine with your kids. And so I said, okay, well, whatever, that sounds all right. You know, as long as that doesn't cause a problem, we're good. So I tell a couple of my buddies about this, and they're all saying, yeah, whatever. So I hired Brenda. She came to work about, I don't know, a week or two before the kids were supposed to come, and she was just great. And when the kids came, she was just great. She was absolutely perfect for what this was. Now, for 5 years, I've been running around trying to get a relationship. I always wanted a wife, girlfriend, picket fence, and stuff like that, and I was not doing a good job of that. And in fact, I was doing a terrible job of that. So I wasn't good at chasing around trying to find anybody. And when she came as a homemaker, or homemaker was what we called her, I said, I am not going to even think about chasing her around because I need her for the kids. So one more time, having a purpose greater than myself allowed me to stay out of trouble. And so she continued on as the homemaker for the kids. She got comfortable in her role, and she started occasionally going out and, you know, taking a night off. And I'm not going to tell you too much of this stuff, but on a Tuesday night, she said she was going to go out and have some birthday cake at a kid's party or something. Oh, no, she wanted to go out for the night, and I said, I was kidding her, sort of like a parent saying, no, you can't go out tonight. Oh, no, it's going to be fine. I'm just going out for birthday cake and tea at my aunt's house or whatever. I said, oh, I was just kidding. Go ahead. Have a good time. Well, she didn't come back until Saturday. Now, somebody tells me they have a mental problem. I don't know what to do with that. But during the course of the week, I found out from relatives that occasionally she drinks too much, and she's probably been on a bender. And I said, oh, well, I know what to do with that. With absolute confidence, if I could get her to come back and go to AA, that would fix her and would fix our situation. Now, that was the level. I was sober 5 years, and that's the way I feel about Alcoholics Anonymous then. That's the way I feel about it now. If we can just get them to come to the well and hang around, they'll get AA. So she agreed to come back. She called, and she figured she was going to come pick up her stuff and whatever. And I said, no, you still got a job. You can come back here as long as you go to, I know what your problem is, and I'll help you with that or something. I don't know, whatever. So I fixed her up with the most solid woman I knew in Sioux City, Iowa, and she's been sober ever since. So not long after that, there was guys chasing her around and AA and stuff, and it started making me nervous, and I started getting more interested. We went to the Cornhusker Roundup and bunked together that time, and after that, we slept in beds and all that. But that's when my intention started changing. Soon after that, we decided to get married, and we've been married ever since. And by the benefit of sponsorship, we haven't killed each other. We've loved each other for all of that time. We're still together and have an enjoyable life. She's active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous. What's really nice about that, there's never a question when it comes up to, I got to go spend some time with a pigeon. I got to go on a 12-step call. The phone's got to be answered at early, and, you know, sometimes there's some screeching, but, you know, for the most part, we understand that stuff. So that's a great asset for somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous who wants to and needs to continue to participate. So we've lived a great life together as a result of being in Alcoholics Anonymous. We moved to Minneapolis after we'd been married a few years. It was about 7 years, and that was an exciting time. I ran one more time. Dick did exactly what I needed he pointed me to Chuck Rice, who was Chuck, who's always been a very active guy in Alcoholics Anonymous in Minneapolis. He said, go find him, and wherever he's going to meetings, go there, which I did. And, you know, he was involved in service. He was involved in everything that was going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I just followed Chuck around and got involved the same way. I had a great time. I was only there temporarily. I was supposed to stay there for a year or two and then go someplace else for an assignment with IBM. And the going-away party that we had when we were going to Madison, Wisconsin, I absolutely did not want to leave. It was the most... I was just bound to Alcoholics Anonymous and the friends that I had there. But I had to leave, left, and I was not happy with what I had found or not found in Madison, Wisconsin, so I was struggling with my involvement in AA. Brenda was too. Some other things happened, and eventually got to the point I said, you know what, there was a guy I knew in Minneapolis, and I said, if you can get me back to Minneapolis, I'm yours. And he did within a couple months, so we've been in Minneapolis ever since then. Kids grew up in pretty much in Minneapolis schools. I want to just touch on a little bit of what's happened with those kids because it's pretty interesting. It has an awful lot to do with what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. My daughter Tracy seemed to think that maybe she had contracted alcoholism while she was off at college because she was drinking too much. And she actually called in a group, and somehow or other this discussion led to somebody saying, well, why don't you just do what it says in the big book, go out and try to do some controlled drinking. Have two drinks a night and see how that goes. And she did fine. And the issue, whatever it was, kind of went away. So I always look at that and say, well, she just didn't have the willpower to be a good, solid drunk. But she did. She was chasing drunks around like crazy. I went to see her. We were at her college. She wanted me to meet her boyfriend. We went over to see the boyfriend. We couldn't wake him up. He's passed out. So I started introducing her to all my young AA friends, thinking if she wants an alcoholic, I'd like her to have a sober one. That'd be good. So that's a Tracy story, and she married a guy that appears to not have alcoholism. I don't know. Maybe it'll show up later. But anyway, they've been married 7 years. Life's good. The kids are, our grandkids are good. So that family is great. And Tracy's the one I told you about. I had that little paper in high school. And she has an unbelievable quality within her that really, I think, has an awful lot to do with Alcoholics Anonymous and the God that was brought into our home for all of us to live with. On the other hand, my son, Skip, every time we'd go to an AA event, we would get this call, like, can I have a few kids over for cards tonight, Dad? Or, you know, after a few of those, he said, no, you're not doing nothing like that, and whatever. No, you're all by yourself, whatever. And in hindsight, he had lots of keggers at the house where hundreds of people would be there, and he was charging $5 a head to get in, and the next-door neighbor was in on it. My top pigeon at the time was in on it. And, in fact, he came over and helped him clean it up one Sunday morning so that when we got home, there wouldn't be this gargantuan mess, and Skip was too hungover to even think about cleaning the place up. So he was starting to have a few bad experiences with drinking. One night, I think he was in his junior year, late in his junior year, he called, and I got on the phone, and his friends had made him call for a ride home. They didn't want him there anymore. He was too sloppy, stupid, drunk. And they didn't want him driving. He had his car there. And they didn't want to take him home. So they made him call me. Now, those are good friends. But they also is indicative of what kind of condition he was in. I mean, they want him out of there. So I said, I'll come get you. And we didn't have any conversation that night. Next morning, he comes down to my office, which was in the home. And he said, I think I might have a drinking problem. And maybe I should go to AA. I said, oh, good. I called my youngest pigeon. I said, you're his sponsor. Take him to AA and get him fixed. And that worked for a little while, but when he got in college, he just the pressure was too much. He came to Des Moines. Many of you know Skip, and he was in and out of AA while he was running around here. Some of you guys might have been a sponsor. I don't know. Some of you drove him to meetings, I'm sure, and sat in meetings with him. And for a while, I think he was a pretty good AA member, but he just got distracted occasionally, and he'd get drunk again. And we got a call one Thanksgiving. And there's a guy in this room here who I think was at the hospital that day. And the call was basically that Skip had tried to slash his wrist and didn't end at all. They ended up sending him to the hospital. And so for him to be released from the hospital, he had to have his parents come get him and so on. This was Thanksgiving Eve. He no longer came home on Thanksgiving because he had to drink. And you can't go see Dad when you got a drink. You can't go spend time with family when you got a drink. I knew that. So we went down to see him, and we went over to a friend's house. I don't remember why, but we're sitting on the couch at a friend's house. And I said, Skip, is there anybody from AA that you want to talk to? And he said, I'd like to talk to Dick Martin. And he knew Dick growing up, and he had seen Dick over the years, and Dick had, you know, been friendly with him. And my notion is that nobody asked Dick Martin to sponsor them unless they really want to stay sober. I mean, you know that you're getting into an active program of participation if you ask Dick to be a sponsor. And I couldn't have been more excited. We got him hooked up with Dick. Dick became a sponsor and basically gave him a path to get out of this mess he was in. And he was in a bad mess with the college, with the Army, with his life, and with his parents, and all of that. But it was such a wonderful thing to be able to turn my son over to Dick Martin and not have to worry about his well-being, because I knew that Dick was objective enough to be able to do better for him than I ever could have. He could better design his plan of recovery and getting him squared away in life, and things worked out great. He graduated from college, he skipped the Army thing and went to work for us, and he's been sober now a dozen years. And his busy wife making babies. The wife is a Alcoholics Anonymous member of 7 years, and they have a great household. And so we have a wonderful AA story in our family, and we pretty much share that, and we share a lot of other things, and particularly around our grandkids these days. So our home group is a very active, large group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it that way. It's exciting for me to show up there on Thursday nights. I always go early if I can, and I always stay late. I like to be last one out, just like when we were at the bars. And I sponsor a lot of guys. My top pigeon is right here, right now, because he rode down with us. And he's the only one who would come. So we have a great life revolving pretty much around Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, we've had a lot of social fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've had a lot of meaningful experiences with helping drunks get and stay sober. And we're a vital part of all that goes on in Alcoholics Anonymous in Minneapolis. So I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to share that, because it always gets me really excited and maybe even a little more enthusiastic about going to do the next right thing. So thank you again for the invitation to be here. Thanks.